No. Okay, so I'm going to ask my question. I have two actually. So the first one, if we think about beyond the surface, initially when you started to talk about this, I saw it as an evolution of essential action. You know, so those four scene analysis questions that you gave us way back at the Love Story Workshop in 2017, I've been watching those evolve as you've been refining the concepts and the questions. So I thought beyond the surface was a refinement of the essential action question. But then when you were explaining it using the diorama, it sounded like you were talking about setups, like the author or narrator setting things up that would be paid off down the road. Is that a further evolution, or am I getting my wires crossed?
Beyond the surface, just it's part of a domain that is the NO thingness. It's the transjective noumenal dimensionality. So the player in the schema of artist, author, avatar, audience, who is responsible for that dimension would be the artist, because the artist is the person who's creating the alternate world and the way things work in that alternate world. So they're the ones who assign value. So it's as if, and I don't mean to offend anybody here, it's as if the artist plays God. So they get to determine the outcomes of all of the things that proceed throughout the story. So it's a little tricky because, yes, it's about value, right? It's about determining what the meaning of each individual unit of scene is about. So that's true. So that's the fourth question, right? Like, what value do I highlight on my spreadsheet? That would be the fourth question of our four. I'm just paraphrasing. I think that's what it is. So that's the determination of meaning. And meaning is aligned with the NO thingness of the transjective. So that's why, you know, like today when I went through thing, KNOW thing, and NOW thing, those are very powerful concepts because you can map them for us in story at many different dimensions of and levels of analysis. So the on the surface, beyond the surface, and above the surface dimensions that I talk about, on the surface is the objective thingness of the story. Above the surface is the KNOW thingness of the story. And the NOW thingness of the story is the beyond the surface. So if you look at NO thingness, that would be sort of the mysterium of creation, of God, of the concepts of the things that we can never know, right? So what we do as storytellers is we take that role of the one who does know. And we assign meaning to everything that we do as we create the story. And then what we have to do is make sure that the signal that we are communicating to the audience is accurate, appropriately fast or appropriately slow, and capable of going great distances. So the meaning-making machinery is at the level of the artist. Now, the artist has an idea. I want to tell a crime story. And then the artist goes down into an aspect of themselves and says, what part of me would be the best person to tell this kind of story? And then it funnels and encodes the story using that point of view narrative device. And then it plays in the world of on the surface action of the objective movements of the story from time to time to time, right? And it's discontinuous, right? So sometimes we start in a durational moment with collapsed action. After the army seized Gibraltar, General Pinochet, blah, 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 right? So that would be starting in a durational time period, right? But if we started in the now, then it would probably be some kind of dialogical thing. Hey, how you doing? Pretty good. And you? I'm just making it up. So the management of all of it ultimately sits with the beyond the surface artist, right? So there's an artist within Valerie, and Valerie is trying to climb up to that artist. And so part of becoming a storyteller is allowing yourself to chase that artist and then listen to what the artist tells you within you. What is capturing your attention? What genres are really seen to be super salient and important to you? Listen to that shit, right? Because that's your artist saying, here's an arena, a domain of the universal arena that Valerie should explore as an artist. And then what you do is you start to explore it by thinking about what part of myself would be a good person to put in this black hole and have them explore for me. And if they get hurt, I can just get somebody else inside of me to do it too, right? So then you separate the Valerie as the artist from the actual work, right? So you don't become so freaking precious that if you make a mistake, that you want to quit because you're not an artist. No, it's just that the author that you chose in that moment to do that thing isn't working out. That's all. Is that a little bit clearer?
Yes, thank you. anyone else have questions? Oh, Lori, go ahead. We can't hear you, Laura. You have to unmute yourself.
Oh, there we go.
There you go. Okay. You got
okay.
it.
Great.
It's working now. Okay. Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you for everything and for the, and Danielle, the course that you're teaching. I've been watching all of the recordings and it's been amazing. And my mind is just going, it's kind of exploded. and I'm trying to make sense of it. A lot of times I'm kind of confused about the depleting and is it enlivening and depleting mm-hmm. part of it. I can't always tell what that means.
Sure. Okay. That, so yeah, I can take it from there and then you can do a follow-up if you want.
No, it's fine.
Okay. So what I was talking about earlier today is that if we look at stimulus coming into us as an audience. Let's say you're reading a book and the stimulus that comes into you is exciting. Say it's an action story and someone ends up running away from somebody and then they get away and you're following the action and all of a sudden they end on a cliff. And there's nowhere for them to go. So the excitement is enlivening to you as the audience member, as you are watching the progression of the story of that person trying to get away from the monster. And then when that avatar hits the edge of the cliff, that would be a moment, a stimulus that causes anxiety in you. It causes anxiety and it sort of depletes you and you sort of even exhale or inhale very quickly, right? So the excitement is leading you to the cliff and you're like, oh my gosh, this is great. They're getting away. Yes, go down that alley. Oh my God, that's amazing. Yeah, good thinking. Oh my gosh, there's nowhere to go now. So the enlivening stimulus to look at it from the point of view of the audience is very, very important. So that would mean that it's exciting them and it's safe to a degree. Anxiety is when it's depleting, it's lowering the hedonic tone. So hedonic tone is when you're positively enlivened or negatively sort of depleted. So positive hedonic tone means you're excited, you're being aroused by the sequence of events. A depletion is when the events have turned such that you're now worried about what's going to happen. You're excited to see what happens next, or you're concerned about what's going to happen next. And so that's the way to look at it at the level of energy transfer from the artist to the audience. So this is the very bottom level of energy transfer. Now, there is another level that we're working on now, which is about the avatar, right? And people get confused because they're putting the avatar, they're substituting the avatar for the audience. And so they're thinking about how is this affecting the avatar in the scene instead of thinking about the person watching the avatar in the scene. Do you kind of get it?
Yes, that's a key point. Yeah. Okay.
So the next level is about the avatar. It's the above the surface level. And that's how the avatar is processing the information in real time or as the scene is progressing or the beats are progressing. Now it's tricky because the audience inevitably empathizes and attaches themselves to the protagonist avatar. So that's why it gets confusing, is that we as readers do that all the time. So when we're analyzing things, we tend to attach ourselves to the protagonist avatar and look at the world through that lens, as opposed to stepping back and looking at it from a third person objective thing in terms of the audience. So that's really the trick here, is whenever you start thinking about, well, she's really excited because she's running away and getting away with it, and then she gets really upset because you got to start looking at it more like from an objective point of view and just think of what is the audience experiencing as they're watching the action.
Okay, thank you. That makes a lot of sense. I'll start doing it that way because I was confusing who I'm looking at it and which way I'm supposed.
Yeah, we do it all the time. All of us do it. So I do it all the time too. It's only natural. So it's not like you're weird or anything. It's just...
Yeah, I kind of am, but yeah, thank you for that explanation.
Sure.
Maria, you posted a question in the chat, but do you want me to read it or do you want to unmute and you can ask yourself?
Sure, Valerie, I'll ask the question. Hi, Sean.
Hi.
I have a new client, thanks to StoryGrid. Thank you very much. She's writing a memoir and we've just started our work together.
Mixed blessings.
Here we go. Yeah. I'm in that tension, so I just wanted to hear some advice from you. So we're just getting started, and she's off to a really good start. She shared 3 or 4 scenes with me, but we are very much at the level of identifying the genres, what the story arc is, you know, because I want her work to focus on scenes and stories that feed that macro level. She went to the Trinity seminar and she's very excited about the beat analysis and has said to me, I think that's just what my work needs. And while that may be true, I'm not sure that now is the time to be focusing on that because in my opinion and coming out of my current StoryGrid training, our work is really at the macro level right now until we drill down into that deeper work. So my thought was, like, I've focused in on one of the scenes that she gave me and have done an analysis of that and inviting her to, like, in the scene, she talks about an episode in her life that episode, in my opinion, needs to be the framing device for the whole chapter, you know, so that we're in that scene with her. And then it, you know, that provides the framework for her to give us some background on her life and that sort of thing. And I think she gets that. But I guess as an editor, I'm feeling a little torn because I don't want to squelch her enthusiasm for the beat analysis by any means. And I know that that will be helpful for us at some point. But from where I see it right now, her work is better served at that macro level, you know, until she's got some of that better ironed out. But I want to hear your feedback on that and see what your suggestions would be.
Yeah, it's sort of like being a physician in a lot of ways, because I see what you're saying, because if she hasn't really constrained the story itself, then to get into the micro details of structuring it and organizing it could be extraordinarily problematic. I understand what you meant when you said that she's reporting an event as opposed to having stimulus and response events actually convey the event in real or durational time or collapsed time, as opposed to reporting. When I was a child, my brother tied me to a tree and left me there for hours is less effective than it was a nice, beautiful spring day. I was looking forward to playing, you know, wiffle ball with my brother and his friends, right?
Yeah.
And now we're like, whoa, what's going to happen now? So the way you can construct that kind of episodic five commandment movement of value shift is to, and this is tricky with memoir, right? Because what you're asking the artist to do is that their instincts are really, really spot on, right? The instinct to write a memoir is to aspectualize yourself and to be able to pull out episodes in your life that were either wonderful or traumatic, usually traumatic, and to get a grip on them, you know, to be able to metabolize them, process those things, and put them clearly on an objective plane such that a third party can read that and go, whoa, I get it now. Yeah, I understand you better. Things are cool. I understand that aspect of you. You're a lot more complex of a person than I initially thought. So that instinct is really, really great, because that's what we all want to do, right? We all want to be able to show our complexity and to let people know that we've gone through some things that are pretty challenging, and we've come over through the other side, and, you know, we should get some validation for that. Totally cool. Now, the problem, though, is that the failure error messages that are inherent when you're generating a memoir can be traumatic in and of themselves, especially when you're working with an editor. So that's why I said it was kind of a mixed blessing when you work with somebody who's writing a memoir, because it really can really morph into a therapeutic relationship far too often and far too quickly than you would probably want. So I think that's probably your hesitancy to get into the micro detail of beats, is because you're concerned that you're going to have to make value judgments about how she's iterating traumatic events from her past on the page. That's your job, right? And to say, that might have been the way it happened, but you got to valence it so that it's clear to the audience. So it might have been a little bit, it was probably super complex about that. And I'm just pulling stuff off the top of my head, so please, everybody, take this with a grain of salt. It may be that the victim of this person's advances had good feelings for them and was interested, but that's really going to make it too squishy for the audience to understand. Because you have to remember, this person was very young and this other person wasn't an adult. So let's not focus, right? We got to valence the fact that this person was taking advantage of this person using chaos or order to their advantage, right? So when you start doing that and they're like, well, it's a little bit more complicated than that, that's when you can get into a hairy situation, because this stuff is very complex, right? So my global advice to you is, yes, start with the macro and say, hey, let's slice out 6 months. And let's put a lot of events in those 6 months that have an arc to them that will be revelatory to the audience by the end of it. And if possible, let's look at it externally, not about internal transformation. Let's look at the external. So what do I mean by external? It was there an event that the person was going through at the same time as a transformational internal kind of thing? Because that's what memoirs are about. I was once this way, now I'm this way, right? So they're maturation or revelatory stories where someone is telling people how they were able to adapt and change such that they fit better. So this is a good way of being able to sort of stay away from the arena of how someone has changed the way they think about things and make it more about an external, and usually performance genre stories are really good for memoirs. Like, you know, the business memoir is always a good one, right? Because the business, like Tim wrote a business memoir, Running Down a Dream. This was a transformational story. It was a memoir about how someone had to change themselves inside in order to change their external circumstances. But what Tim didn't write about how he, you know, he was upset about specific moments in his time and he was crying and stuff. He talked about the external challenges, like the guy knocking on the door saying, where's my money? And his wife at the grocery store not being able to buy, you know, groceries because the credit card was, right? Those are really great external things that show internal problem. And then the audience can understand that, because all of us empathize with those things. And Tim doesn't have to say, I was so worried about not being able to provide for my family at that time. And well, you don't want to read that. You just want to see poor Candace at the grocery store not being able to pay the groceries, because that's kind of like, sorry to use you again, Tim. I'm always shocking the monkey, the Tim monkey. Yeah.
What I'm here for.
All right. So what's my advice? My advice is take a very small sliver. And when she says, I remember when this thing happened to me, go, hey, let's play with that for a little bit. And let's convert it from a report of what had happened to us. Like, let's rip it apart and let's do the external moments of stimulus and response that actually got you to that change. So like just the example of like, my brother did tie me to a tree one morning, so I couldn't play wiffle ball with everybody.
But now it comes out. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure that's pretty obvious, right? So if I were to tell that story, it would be about the hope of connection from a little brother to his big brother and his group, right? So there's this want, this desire to connect to a sibling, and then the betrayal of that sibling for the entertainment purposes of his group of friends, right? And how at the end of that little story, the audience hopefully would recognize it as true and sad, and difficult. One of the difficult things we have to learn as we're when we're little is where we put our trust. And these are the moments in time when those things happen. So I wouldn't want to write, I learned how to trust better after a circumstance I had as a little boy when my brother tied me to a tree. You see, he betrayed me, but because it's just like a clinical report that is not engaging. It's not exciting. It's and it's also sort of the point of view isn't very good because we want to see it happen. We want to see all the hopes and dreams dashed. And so that's the tricky part in memoir because it's very personal. So that's getting them to be able to recognize what aspect of their artistry they want to be telling the story is important because they're going to want to go in it from a global artist's point of view. And what they do have to, this is what happened with To Kill a Mockingbird. Once she put herself as a 5-7-year-old girl, then it was solved, right? But when she's writing it as a 30-year-old person writing about a traumatic experience when she's young, it didn't work so well. But when she got that aspect of her interiority, that was the 7-year-old scout. And when she wrote through that lens, then it was, it hummed, you know, it was flowed like butter. And so that's the trick with your clients. Like, what aspect of your client can she use to employ to tell this story? And that will give her a gap between and a single aspect of her herness and the great beauty of her multi-aspectual artistry, right? So that's what I would say to her is like, hey, we need to sort of like get a little cushion here because you're going to have to be writing some stuff that's probably going to feel really difficult. And I'm going to have to criticize it, you know? And I'm going to have to say, this just isn't valenced enough and I don't care. And the audience isn't going to care about that trauma. And that could hurt her as an artist if she doesn't rip out this one aspect and use that, that as the author narrator. Because then you can say, hey, I don't know if this author narrator that you've chosen is up to the task. Is there somebody else inside of you that you could bring down here? And then that way there's that nice little cushion where it doesn't, your criticisms do not, aren't taken so deeply and painfully. And you could just keep repeating that. Hey, you have to remember, I am not criticizing you as the artist because holy cow, boy, are you courageous to even go near this stuff. Wow, amazing. What I am saying is that the signal isn't that strong using this particular narrator. Do you have another narrator in there we could use? What do you think? Maybe you should be writing in about the time when you were when you experienced it, or maybe what do you think? Right. So engage them in stripping out an aspect of themselves so that they can separate the whole from the part. Because all of our trauma is just a part of who we are. It's not our whole. That's tricky, right? Because when we direct our attention at a specific trauma all the time, then we start to bullshit ourselves and think that's all we are. That one aspect of my life is all that is me. And that's not true. There's so many infinite aspects and moments in our lives that we can direct our attention to, right? We can be captured by trauma because why? It's traumatic. And we need to cycle that shit and get it out of our life, right? Not get it out, but just say, oh, yeah, that was a moment that wasn't so great. And the good stuff, too. You know, I might have inflated that. Maybe I didn't win the state championship. And maybe, right? Like, maybe that's. So this is the means by which you can help a memoir writer really lock in a specific aspect. And then they can tactfully and appropriately tell that story in such a way that it makes sense and can be signaled to a third party such that they can say, well, yeah, I remember when I was, my brother treated me pretty poorly too when I was little, but we made up, you know, he also did some pretty great things too. So That's the trick with memoir, and it's dicey. But at least here's the good side of it, right? At least the person has already signaled to you that they are ready to look at individual events in their life in a way from a fresh lens. A lot of people who write fiction, that's what they're doing, but they don't know it. And then they get very intractable when you say, I think you need to change this. What do you mean? This is great. And they're actually writing memoir, but they're bullshitting themselves that it's all made up stuff that never, ever, you know, that just came to them from the sky.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. That really confirms something that I did, because I was putting I had comments in the document and then was offering a summary in the word in my email, and it's all in preparation for a consultation by phone. And I had that very sense that if this just goes to her in writing, I don't want her to hear what you just described, Sean. So I actually recorded a video on Zoom to sort of give her the overall feel, you know, to accompany my notes. And I said, understand that when I say, does this serve the story? What I mean is, when we've identified your genre and your controlling idea, then we're going to want to pull the scenes from your life that support that arc. And we haven't identified that yet. And so understand that my language might say, does this serve the story? That does not in any way minimize what your experience is. It's not a comment on your experience. And so being in that point of tension for me right now, when I hear her saying, boy, I'm so excited about this beat analysis, in my opinion, she's really not there yet. And so I think what you're helping me understand is that I can continue on this path of, you know, we've identified an episode from her life. We can, you know, apply the 5 C's to that and then drill down from there as necessary. But I just feel like we've got a lot of that, you know, at a more macro level than the beat analysis. We've got more of that work to do right now. We're just getting started, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I think that what is really awesome about storytelling is that the discovery process emerges at its own accord. And sometimes you have to feel out the storyteller. And the fact that she's excited about beats says to me, it might not be the worst thing to just start with a simple stimulus and response beat and work them with her. And what might happen, what probably will happen, is that she is going to start to center and direct her attention to a particular value. And she's going to start, you know, iterating a very, very clear value that could be the key to discovering the genre that she should be working in, as opposed to top-downing the genre, you're bottom-up in the genre.
I got it, yeah.
So it doesn't, I think what you want to do is toggle, right? Like come up, like ask her, you know, what is a very clear part of your story that you know has to be in there? So let's do a couple of beats in that domain and let's try some active beats, right? And so that way she can start ordering the protagonist and the stimulus too. That's a big deal. And she can start dealing with valence language, right? And that way you're sort of bottom upping. And then what will probably happen is that there's some value, some universal value that is going to keep coming up. And then you can take that value and map it onto a genre and go, you know what? I think you might be writing a crime story, or I think you might be writing a performance story, right? And then she go, what do you mean? You go, well, look at your beats. These are all moving on these values about respect or validation or justice or so. That's another trick. And the other thing is, like, whenever you get someone who's excited about doing something, if you can go there with them, that's the way to go, because it's so hard to do anything.
Well, Sean, I was going to ask in this context of like, because what I was thinking is, would it be worth like having the client go through the worksheets Danielle's creating separate from the particular memoir? Because what I've been thinking is, we've looked at the pilot program and everything of like, let's get her painting fences, you know, while you're working on the macro. And maybe even it would be best to work on sentences or beats that aren't related to the memoir, so that she's just getting used to like writing at that micro level. So then when it comes time of like, okay, now we've got our scenes laid out, you've got to write this really intense scene, she's got some practice under her belt of like generating these beats. Because this is what I'm interested to see is over the next year of using these, not just in the guild, but with clients, of like how we can get them like, work over here, work over here, work over here, and then apply it to your writing, and all of a sudden you're going to see a jump up in the line by line writing when you're now ready to apply it.
I think that's a really good idea, because it devalues the chicken sexing part of it, right? So you're not you don't have any emotional baggage when you're analyzing other people's stuff, and when you're just, meh, let me try this one. You're not even you don't have any weight to that. So that might be a technique that you could do, Maria, is just, you could use some of this the materials that Danielle's generated for that are going to be in the guild. Is your client in the guild?
Yes.
Oh,
Yes, she
great.
is. Yeah.
Great.
So I could direct her to them. Yeah. And
Yeah,
we
I
could
would
work
say,
with
you
her
know
on that.
what? Why don't we have 10, 15 minutes of our weekly call or whatever you're doing, and we'll just go through the guild stuff. And then we'll just see what percolates in terms of mapping out the macro for you, for your story. And that way you can be sort of her buddy going through the material that doesn't have any emotional weight to it. And then you can start mapping and go, hey, maybe that kind of beat would be good for this. Just a thought, right? And then you can build it that way. And I like the separation of, the sort of analytical stuff with the very subjective, deep, psychological stuff. That's a really good idea, Tim.
Nice. Well, thank you both very much. Thank you, Danielle and Leslie, too, for your work on that.
All right, how's everybody else? Anyone else have some questions? Because I have another one, but I won't jump in. I could pelt Sean with questions all day long, but I want to make sure everyone else has a chance to speak. Because all I need is an open mic. You all know that. Okay, so I'll ask my next question. And this is writer Valerie. This is editor Valerie. Editor Valerie asking on behalf of writer Valerie, because I haven't actually asked you this question yet. What advice do you have for writers doing non-linear stories? Because that's what I'm writing. I've done a lot of research, and I'm sure everyone has had this experience where your client comes in and they want to write a 9-book epic fantasy with 180 characters and 45 plot lines, and they're nonlinear, and it's all super advanced stuff. I've had to give myself a talking to because I was starting to do that. So I've pared it down, but I can't make the story work in a linear fashion. So, and I've driven Leslie crazy with this. So I've studied some nonlinear stories, and I'm piecing together some things that work, but what is your advice? What's the key, in your opinion, from having worked with so many writers, to make a nonlinear story work?
Well, it has to have there are techniques that enable the flow to continue effortlessly for the audience. So linearity is it's not really part of a story, of course, has a beginning, middle, and end, but it's discontinuous. which means that you have the ability to do a lot of compression of action. You can flash back, flash forward. And the trick with flashback and flash forward is that those flashbacks and flash forwards have to be triggered by stimulus, right? So a lot of people think that I'll do this block of time as they're a child, and then I'm going to flash forward to when they're a grandparent, and then I'm going to wrap it up with, you know, the process by which they were an adult. And that's too top down, and nobody wants to read that. But if you are taking a story where something happens to a character, and then as they are dealing with what's going on, they go back in time and think about and pull up an episodic memory, you can actually go to that memory and then play it out in a real scene. And then you can go back to where they were, but it has to be bound and flowy, as opposed to just blocky and not stitched together. So the trick is, it's always stimulus that has to trigger the flashback or flash forward. So in the time of the beginning, middle, and end of the through line of the story, you can go back in time, but you have to come back and pick up where it left off. So I think French Lieutenant's Woman or something like that, it's like, Mrs. Dalloway, right? So as she's going around town, she flashes back and flashes forward. And we experience the world as she experiences it in multiple time dimensions, but there's a through line of time of her, been a very long time before I read this, but before her like going shopping and then coming home. And in that expanse of time, we experience the world of Mrs. Dalloway, right? And that's a whole beautiful technique that, you know, Virginia Woolf was really good at. but it's really about the stimulus triggering memory or simulation, and sometimes simulation based on memory. So another little thing to think about simulation is that we can simulate a future in which it's an ideal goal state, but we also can simulate catastrophe, right? So Leslie and Danielle and I have been talking a lot about the five personality traits recently, and there's this binary simulator in us. And this is really the person who deals with security and exploration. So this sort of sub-personality within us, this is a terrible word that they use to pathologize it. They call it the neuroticism trait. And there's an anti-neuroticism trait, right? So what the functionality of neuroticism is the ability to pick up chaotic pattern, right? Patterns of chaos are highly salient to the neurotic. And so what those patterns of chaos are change and novelty. And that is in our systems, evolutionarily, that gives us negative hedonic tone. So the neurotic person usually has a susceptibility to depression, anxiety, et cetera, but it doesn't mean that that functionality is pathological. It's actually quite functional, because what it enables that person to do, that part of them, because you have both, you don't have just one. So it's an opponent process, right? So you have the ability to pick up on chaotic patterns and deal with them in terms of simulating catastrophic failure. And you have the ability to see chaotic patterns and simulate opportunity, right? So it's the same thing in memory, right? Remember, I was just talking about trauma, right? Like, we can look at aspects of trauma from one pole and call it that, when it's not that. It's a lot of different things, right? So the opposite of the Sean gets tied to a tree when he's a kid and doesn't get to be able to play wiffle ball with his big brother and his friends, the good part of that is that was an opportunity for Sean to understand his place. It wasn't that his brother was that bad. It wasn't Sean's place to be able to play wiffle ball at that time. I was too young, and I learned that. And yeah, it was a painful lesson, but I learned it. It was good, right? So knowing your place is an important thing to learn, and it can be traumatic, but it's also good, right? So when you're doing flash forwards, the avatars can mix it up. You could have the catastrophic, neurotic part of that character formulating all the shit that's going to go wrong. Oh, and then they can also justify that by what? Going into their past and pulling up memory that was traumatic and saying, oh, every time I do that, that shitty thing happens. Whenever I try and say hi to somebody, they treat me like shit, right? So you can see how that can become a cycling system that has to be broken apart. And vice versa. They're also like the people who never think anything's going to go wrong, and then slam, they get slammed, right? So it's the opponent processing systems of the sort of the neurotic, anti-neurotic. And we have a phrase that I came up with. The neurotic usually has attachment problems. So they don't feel at home. They never feel like they can integrate well. So they are searching for a home. And the opposite are people who are homed in their search. So they feel confident that there's a secure place for them somewhere. And so when they search, they always got this in the back pocket, right? Oh, I can always go back to Aunt Jim, Aunt Mabel. Aunt Mabel will always have a bed for me, right? So being homed in your search is good, but you can't. What if Aunt Mabel can't let you in there, right? So you got to do the opponent processing and balance these things. And certain domains you can home yourself in. Like, I'm really home in talking about story. But if you want to ask me about how to fix a lawnmower, not so good. I kind of get negative hedonic tone in a domain that I don't know so well. I'm not homed in it. And this is a way to look at how people simulate and how they reflect back. And so when you can sort of, so the stimulus obviously is going to have a trigger that will trigger that avatar on trauma or success in the past. Oh, I'm really good at this game. That's success. Oh God, I'm not a good swimmer. That's trauma. And so you see how you can build the avatars. You can see the personality that can emerge with the behavior of the avatars, and that signal gets transmitted to the audience. Is that helpful?
Okay. Yeah. So the storylines have to play off one another and have to be sort of woven together, where something that happens in one portion of the story is raising questions about another, you know, either what's going to happen there, or it's setting something up that happens somewhere else. So they're constantly playing off each other rather than being separate units that are just side by side in a, like a train cars, right?
Yeah. Anything that the avatar is simulating or remembering has to be linked.
Right.
Right. So the memory is, it emerges when that stimulus, that invisible fear gorilla has, here it comes again. Oh shit. I'm not really good with this. So those are another way of saying setups for payoffs later, because what you're doing is you're sending the message to the audience. Here's the domain that this character has to, you know, adapt to. They need to metabolize this kind of stimulus, or they're not going to fit any longer in this world. And that's no good. Then they're lost and alienated. So home as a concept is a good one, right? So the character at the beginning of the story is usually at some level of home. They feel comfortable, but then stimulus comes in that makes them leave their home. And now they're in an alien world. And when you're in an alien world, things don't go so well for you because you're misreading stimulus all the time. Mm-hmm. And so the process is about how to adapt to that new place, to home it. And it requires a fall, a breakup of the machinery that homed you in the first place. So it's a leveling up, right? Because when the new machinery emerges, the worldview 2.0 at the bottom of the third quadrant, guess what? It still has worldview 1.0. You can still go back there. You can still integrate. You know what to do. Like, I can go back to Pittsburgh and I know what sandwich to order. You know, I know how many beers to have before they kick me out of the bar, you know, but I don't, like, I can always go back there, but it's going to be different because now I've got a completely different worldview. But I can still fit, but then I feel a little alien too. So this is why people don't want to change, right? Because when you transform yourself, you kill a little bit, you kill the ego worldview from the previous life. And while you can still go back there and pretend, you're not what you once were, for good and for ill.
Thank
oh boy,
you.
I've got 2 minutes. I've got a thing I should do.
Okay. Anyone else question that he can answer in about a minute and a half? No.
No.
All right. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. We'll see you next month.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.